Okay, well, let's make a start. Thank you all very much for coming, and welcome to the first of our research seminars for this term. And by ours, I mean our research unit on Southeast Europe, LISI, which is housed here at the European Institute. And it gives me great pleasure that our first speaker this term is not only an expert in the field of the study of the relationship between the European Union and the Western Balkans, but is also affiliated to LISI and a long-term friend of both LISI and the European Institute, Professor Adam Fagan from Queen Mary University of London. Adam is a professor of European politics at Queen Mary, and he's also head of the School of Politics for his sins, the School of Politics and International Relations. When are you giving that up, Adam?
to be discussed later.
Okay. He was recently a professorial fellow here at the LSE, as I suggested before, and he is a co-investigator in the EU-funded MaxCap project, which is maximising the integration capacity of the European Union. As you can tell from the title of today's talk, Evaluating the EU's New Approach to Judicial Reform in the Western Balkans, Unintended Consequences or Unrealised Goals, a lot of Adam's work focuses on the Western Balkans, on the Europeanisation of the Western Balkans, with particular reference to judicial reform, minority rights, environmental governance, and so on and so forth. I don't want to make a lengthier introduction because most of you will be familiar with Adam anyway and his work. So without any further ado, over to you, Adam.
Spiros, thank you very much for those very kind words. And I just want to echo how nice it is to be here. They say that familiarity breeds contempt, and it just breeds fear. I think I sort of know so many people so well that you know, you can't walk off into the distance hoping you'll never see people again. So that's sort of making me tremble a little bit. And I just want to sort of add a few caveats and say a little bit about the context of where this paper comes. It is very, very much a kind of first iteration of the MaxCap findings. MaxCap, maximising the integration capacity of the European Union, which was an FP7 grant led by Tanya Burtzel and Antonina Dimitrova. The aim of the project, the aim of the grant, the huge MaxCap jamboree, as it were, was to look at EU instruments and approaches, procedures, strategies and policies, how they worked in Central Eastern Europe. So the first stage was to sort of theorise and to critique the effectiveness of these tools and strategies, and then to address this fundamental question of how EU approaches for the remaining candidates and potential candidates, and indeed the neighbourhood countries, could be reformed and revised and tinkered with and made more effective. And very early on in the project, Frank Schimmelfelling talked about and did quite a very good working paper that's on the website, which has been very much a sort of foundational paper, which talks about kind of external integration and internal integration. So, and within this broad framework, the various partners have worked on different topics and aspects, and not surprisingly, I've been working on the Western Balkans. As Spiros said, my previous work has focused on environmental governance, civil society involvement, and non-state actors. And I am unapologetically, as James knows, we did a double act at the House of Lords a few months ago, I'm objectively and unapologetically a sort of cautious optimist about the transformative power of Europe. And I think it's important to say that because otherwise, some of my comments and conclusions would look more naive than perhaps you'll think they are, that I come to this with a conviction that Europe can transform, and it's most effective in transforming the way policy making and the way laws are developed. And of course, I would endorse the concerns about implementation, but also the work of people like Rolda Vassani and Tanya Burtzel, who've emphasised the importance of the domestic variable. I want to also add that although I am broadly optimistic, I think that there's a very fundamental methodological problem that I think the MaxCap project has looked at and talked about, and that is that some of the very positive assertions about the transformative power of Europe, there was insufficient variation on both the independent and the variable. You know, there were a small group of countries that were far too similar, and therefore this rather audacious set of conclusions drawn about the transformative power of Europe. And then, of course, once there was a move south-eastwards, then the addition of conflict and of state fragmentation and a whole host of other variables made these tools look even more ineffective and somewhat deficient. And then we have to add, of course, the recent experience of Hungary and now Poland. And even for somebody who's relatively optimistic and positive about the transformative power of Europe, it begins to look like a much more complex set of issues. And in some ways that reiterates or reinforces the importance of MaxCap and the sort of work that we've been doing as part of the project. And there's certainly been a very lively, other people may well have, I know Eddie certainly was at one of our, I think our midterm conference. And there's been very lively discussions. And that brings me, I worked on judicial reform. I was a little bit reluctant to do so initially, partly because I never saw myself as somebody who'd work on judicial reform. And in fact, just preparing this paper, I was head of school. I don't give papers quite as often as I should, so I get a little bit anxious. In fact, very anxious about how to deliver. And I was thinking, my God, you know, how have I ended up doing this sort of research? It doesn't mean I think it's all very dull and uninteresting, but it doesn't quite sit comfortably with somebody who, you know, who was interested in things that were green and the civil society. However, I'm reminded of two things. And this goes back to an earlier period when, just during my PhD and the early part of my academic career, when I was writing on the Czech Republic and the sort of growing pains or the teething troubles of post-communism. And one thing that always struck me was how little emphasis there was and thought went into constitutional reform and judicial reform. And even though I didn't work on it and avoided it like the plague, it seemed to me the most peculiar thing that there was all this work done on institutions, political parties, and even civil society, which, and yet the core challenge of post-communism, socialism, seemed to me the separation of an independent judiciary and to try to departitize or depoliticize the judiciary and to sort of put the rule of law into some sort of liberal democratic framework. And if you look very hard, there is a tiny literature which says that actually the tension is between autonomy or a tendency to want to create independent judiciaries as a way of separation of powers, but also not at the expense of accountability, checks and balances. So that tension between a kind of checks and balances and a kind of building the capacity and the autonomy of judges. And I mention that because that's really where this debate and this paper, this work is situated. It's about that tension. But obviously under the spotlight in this research and in this paper is the EU's new approach. This new approach that has been trialled in Serbia and Macedonia, but is proving to be very influential in the way that the Commission deals with the other countries in the Western Balkans. And indeed, of course, also beyond countries with an enlargement perspective. So that's what I'm really interested in, the new approach. I come to this, as I say, as somebody who believes that there is enough new in the new approach to merit it being called so, or in terms of so, but equally somebody who recognises that there are problems. The work that we've done for MaxCap has involved significant and extensive empirical work in all of these countries. And I'm in one of those situations where I'm very data rich, but very time poor, and also at the point at which I look at this data and think, well, I'm not an area studies person, and some things I do find really fascinating about the way Albania has organised its judiciary, but in fact I need to sort of put this into some conceptual framework. So what I'm trying to do here is talk first about, what I want to do is talk about the new approach and some of the focus and some of the questions that we've been grappling with, and then to just focus on Serbia and Montenegro and just pull out a few things which I think are illustrative of some of the difficulties that the EU is facing and some of these unintended consequences that I think are being generated. And then time, depending, I will either leave it there or try and draw some tentative conclusions. But it is very much a kind of, it's not the beautiful vase by any means, it's the lump of clay that I've dumped on the wheel at this stage. So please do take that into consideration. Okay, so a little bit about, first about the new approach. Drawing on the experience of previous accession processes, particularly Bulgaria, Romania and Croatia, the Commission proposed a new approach, as it called it, in October 2011. And this was for future entrants that sought membership of the EU. The EU rests, the new approach rests on the principle that issues relating to the judiciary and fundamental rights, which is chapter 23 of the acquis, and justice, freedom and security, otherwise chapter 24, have to be, and I quote here, these should be tackled early in the accession process and the corresponding chapters opened accordingly on the basis of action plans, as they require the establishment of convincing track records. The Commission would report regularly at all stages of the process on progress achieved in these areas along milestones defined in the action plans with, where appropriate, the necessary corrective measures. EPA funds, and I emphasise that deliberately, EPA funds will be targeted to support this process. I love how the Commission sometimes talks about itself in the third person, another time. It's bizarre how Commission English, but that's another story. The important point there was that it is prioritisation of two chapters of the acquis. Now, when I was writing about environmental governance and in previous projects and work that I did, the thing that I talked about, and I was by no means original in my thinking, was that what was so bizarre was the EU seemed to allow countries almost to define what they wished to prioritise and their own hierarchy in terms of which policy areas they felt they should respond to. And if you look at the progress reports, which I'm sure everybody in this room has done at some unfortunate moment in their research, you know, there is no sort of sense in really as to what is important or what the Commission values or sees as a priority. And a whole academic narrative emerged, both from a sort of rationalist institutionalism, but also from a more constructive view that said, well, obviously countries respond and approach different issues because they can bring more to the table with certain issues than they can others. Some things fit logic of appropriateness, whatever it is. I always forget which one it is. But nevertheless, you know. So there's this idea of a scattergun. You could do what you wished. So certain countries made a big play for environmental governance, which was very handy. And other countries prioritised other things. And chapters 23 and 24 could be opened towards the end. And indeed, with Croatia, they were opened, I think a year or so before Croatia joined, and closed almost at the point of the country joining. And not surprisingly, this meant that there was no real time for the Commission to assess implementation or to evaluate or judge any kind of track record. So really this new approach, and the quote that I'm saying is that actually this is about making sure that not only is 23 and 24 the starting chapters of the acquis or the starting process, but they start with benchmarking. They start with a process of consultation with stakeholders and with civil society in order to identify the key issues that need to be tackled under the broad remit of 23 and 24. And also this reporting regularly. I mean, many of us in the room, I think wherever we sit on these sorts of debates, would are horrified, I think, quite rightly, by the whole drama or the theatre of the progress reports. You know, all of a sudden the EU stands as judge and juror, and is quite happy if you line them up over 4 or 5 years, which I did actually this morning preparing this because I wanted to just check the commentary on Serbia and political interference in the judiciary. You know, the narrative is slightly changed occasionally, but it's, you know, the EU didn't seem to have any problem with just reporting no progress, as if it had no responsibility whatsoever for that outcome. So I think there is a lesson that, you know, if we're talking about lessons learned, which is what really I'm trying to decipher in this research, I think that is one of them, insofar as, you know, the EU has to invest in a regular monitoring, a regular process, and also to intervene in the interim to say, okay, well, you've been derailed, or these objectives have not been set. So I think it's very important, because I think when we talk about the new approach, there's a tendency to just think just about the prioritisation of these two chapters. But in fact, there's more about the process and the mechanisms. And there's also, if you look at the actual wording, they also say that progress on these two chapters will determine the opening of subsequent chapters, which I think, again, is an important way of building a set of priorities and a hierarchy of what's important and what is not. So that's the new approach. Now, it happened to coincide with opening of negotiations with Serbia and Montenegro. So Serbia and Montenegro offer a very obvious test case studies. So although as part of the MATSCAP deliverables that I was involved in, we looked at 23 and 24 in all of the countries of the Western Balkans. Obviously, the applicability to Serbia and Montenegro is more relevant. However, one of the findings, certainly of the research, is that this emphasis on rule of law, security, freedom, justice, is penetrating and agenda setting in all the other countries, irrespective of how near or how far they are from opening up chapters and negotiating their entry. A little bit of thought needs to go into, I think, a bit further thinking about why the EU... while he's doing this. It's an obvious point that, of course, goes back to my rather glib comment at the beginning about the lack of research or lack of interest, perhaps, on the rule of law in the context of post-communism. I think there's an element of that, that perhaps there's a realisation on behalf of the EU that actually, you know, this is pretty fundamental, and if these issues aren't dealt with right from the outset, that all other things... There's a backtracking, that you're always backpedaling or trying to sort of compensate. I think more importantly, it's the legacy of Bulgaria and Romania and the need for these CDM in order to sort of, after the event, try to make sure that there was formal compliance, but there was actually change on the so-called on the benches, as Christina Parro referred to it. But I think there's also quite a bit of thinking around the situation and the importance of the rule of law and judicial reform within the EU amongst existing member states. And certainly there's been quite a lot of interesting research done, both in the academic sphere but also within the EU and in the policy world, about the link between economic stability, the rule of law, and social mobility and social stability. So I think the shift towards the new approach is something that really... comes from both the experience of most recent entrants, but also an element of understanding of the linkage between the economy and social stability. I think there is also a very strong element, and particularly with regard to Serbia, of the importance of the rule of law. And without, again, making a rather sort of throwaway comment about Serbia, and we'll talk about Serbia in a moment, but I think that the legacy of the ICTY, and I'm thinking particularly the work of Mladen Ostojic, who wrote a very good book on transitional justice and regime change in Serbia, and then very early on in the book he makes a point about the symbolism of the ICTY and what was that saying about Serbian judiciary and the rule of law in Serbia. So I think when we sort of, you know, spend a lot of time looking at judicial change in Serbia under this sort of aegis of the new approach, you know, I often was quite struck by how poignant this was. You know, this is about saying we are prioritising that in a particularly complex country. The challenge is, and I've made reference to this already, has been to how to secure the right balance between independence or autonomy of judges, but not severing both formal and informal channels of accountability or chains of accountability, and linkages of accountability, chains is not the right word. And that seems to be a huge, huge problem, because the EU's instinctive approach or strategy is very much based around judicial academies and judicial institutions, and bolstering the training and the expertise and the specialism of judges. So its approach, certainly in all of these countries, seems to be about train judges better, make them better, build their capacities, train a new generation as quickly as you can, and without specifying this overtly, try and get rid of the old guard as quickly as you can. And therefore, the tendency is to say, you know, the more independence you can build for judges, in other words, putting them on the top of the hill and keeping politicians, party elites, even the public away from them, the better. So this sort of cordon sanitaire. Now, immediately it's evident that that is a flawed strategy insofar as the accountability and the checks and balances are different from direct politicisation. But what I argue in the working papers on which this talk and this paper is drawn is there's a fundamental confusion. A confusion between independence and accountability, but also the idea that somehow if you make judges independent, then you have automatically reduced political interference. And a lack of understanding that actually the more independence or the more autonomous that the judges become, the greater the political interference can, because they become more significant in the decision-making process or in the political process, and therefore they arguably become an even greater target. So this tension between independence and accountability is really what is limiting the EU's new approach, and that's what I'm arguing. It's limiting because the new approach, despite its emphasis on the importance of involving stakeholders and civil society and dialogue and track record and the importance of change on the benches, it nevertheless focuses in terms of the EPA funding and the twinning projects on building institutions, training, and what you might describe as rather top-down strategies to rapidly transform judicial practice. Now, I started off, it looks like I'm contradicting myself. You know, I'm not by any means rubbishing the new approach in its entirety. Quite the contrary. I think there's an awful lot that that is positive and that is certainly delivering benefit. But nevertheless, there are a series of assumptions that are fundamentally flawed. And most of those come from a lack of, or rather an insufficient attention being paid to the particular domestic context. Now, if we go back to Bulgaria, Romania, and to a certain extent Croatia, but particularly Bulgaria and Romania, and even to the Central East European countries that entered in 2004, the variation in judicial compliance or transformation or reform of the rule of law can be explained in two ways. One way, internally, because there are significant differences between the countries. And I said at the outset that one of the peculiar things about this whole literature on Europeanisation was it took very similar countries and exaggerated the transformative power on the basis of very similar countries. However, one of the areas where there was most difference was in the rule of law, despite legacies of Soviet-style communism. The second explanatory factor is that there is no hard acquis when it comes to justice and rule of law. And I know Ellie has talked about and written about this as well. In other words, the EU is not particularly prescriptive in terms of the type of institutions and the type of arrangements around the rule of law and judicial independence and the relationship between the three tiers of government, partly because obviously amongst the existing member states there is a significant variation. So comparing it to environmental acquis, for example, or environmental compliance, where there's a very clear set of hard directives and laws that need to be incorporated, it's very simple in that regard, this is something that's much more complex. So I think that certainly if we're looking at one of the problems of the new approach, one of the biggest difficulties, it is precisely the fact that there isn't the clarity. The EU doesn't speak with a clear and precise voice in terms of what it expects. Now, I'm going to now move into giving some examples from the literature. I'm going to start with the example of Serbia here, because Serbia, and many people in the room will know the details of this, and I won't go into a huge lengthy discussion about this necessarily, but this idea of reappointment of judges that Marko Kmezić and others have talked about and written about. The EU, surprisingly, initially was quite quiet about whether they endorsed it, but then very quickly became terrified about the prospect of basically getting rid of experienced judges in a way that was very non-transparent and in no way clear, and substituting experienced judges with a whole new tranche that had come out of the Judicial Academy with no experience, but also with very heavy political interference. In other words, the whole process seemed to be achieving exactly the opposite of what was intended. Now, the EU initially was quite okay about that and said, well, you know, this is a domestic initiative, but it was designed to replace Milosevic era and Yugoslavia era judges, and that was therefore approved of. And also, it was a way to get in place properly, in inverted commas, better trained judges. What it ignored, of course, was the fact that many judges had left, and as the statistics are in the paper, already had left. So, in fact, it was using a sledgehammer to crack a, whatever it is, a walnut or a peanut or something. But also, it completely backfired. And those who know about the whole case, many of the judges had to be reinstated, and the Constitutional Court intervened to overturn the strategy. So the EU seemed to be on the side of something which actually ultimately served to discredit the judiciary in the eyes of the public. Again, one of the most dangerous unintended consequences or side effects of any kind of interference. So a second example would be the Judicial Academy in Serbia. Again, this was set up, top-down initiative, strongly encouraged by the EU, funded and supported by the EU, talked about in many of the reports and opinions, that basically replaced the judicial training councils that had been very much a bottom-up initiative in the previous period. Again, a series of unintended consequences, most notably that the links, the accountability, the connection between the legislature and the executive were seriously hampered. So in terms of the influence of the EU, the emphasis on training and the emphasis on building institutions, invariably new institutions, is something that comes out as a problem in all of the countries, in all of the empirical sections of the research. But there is virtually no example where this emphasis on institutions and this emphasis on technical capacity building hasn't engendered some kind of complexity. I now want to, I don't know how I'm doing for time, probably not very well, but I just want to spend a few minutes, if that's okay, talking about Montenegro, because I've said something about Serbia, but I'd like to just point out, and it's very brief, but I just want to look at Montenegro from the perspective of the new approach and the EU and what the EU perhaps has achieved and not achieved. The message from the research, or rather what seems to emerge from the research that we did on Montenegro, is that at one level it looks like an absolutely perfect case of the new approach delivering progressive change. Constitutional reform, constitutional change, a raft of new laws and measures to clarify the relationship between the judiciary and executive and the legislature, a bolstering of the constitutional court, a great deal of change around the composition of the Judicial Academy and various other bodies. Very prescriptive about how judges and Supreme Court judges and the chief will be appointed and dismissed, etc. And this looks as though the perfect correlation almost between EU pressure, emphasis on 23 and 24, and change. And certainly the existing tiny literature that we started by really almost panders to that narrative. But this is a classic case of a country that wanted to respond, that wanted to, that had propelled its membership forward and was prepared to do anything it could in order to get in. The conclusion that we've drawn after the interviews with both with civil society organisations, with judges, with those working in the legal profession, was that in fact the EU's role was quite marginal. And that yes, there was a momentum for constitutional reform, but this was largely coming from the Venice Commission, and the Council of Europe was had been absolutely critical at an earlier point. Now that doesn't discredit, in my eyes, the new approach particularly, but it does illustrate the kind of perils of assuming a level of impact of Europeanisation, which again, those of you who've worked on Europeanisation in Central Eastern Europe or South Eastern Europe will know that whole obsession with assuming that everything, every change is a direct occurrence, and not seeing that sometimes Europe's role is somewhat of an intervening variable or an intervening factor. So Montenegro's a very interesting story. On paper, it looks as though there is a good balance between independence and accountability. And certainly, when we initially looked at all the data and looked at all the countries, it looked as though, more than any other country, they got it right. They seem to have secured or put in place a kind of membrane of accountability whereby judges were independent or autonomous, and yet there was a sort of checks and balance meshed in a system of checks and balances. However, then you look at the political context and you start to sort of punctuate the reforms with a wider context. The fact that one party has dominated Montenegrin politics for 20, if not longer, 20-odd years, and therefore the theatre or the infrastructure, if you like, the infrastructure of this kind of membrane of accountability begins to look somewhat different. And we talk about this in the paper about the fact that, okay, you know, yes, there are limits to what party officials and politicians, how far they can trespass formally, but really there is still an earlier period of judicial appointment which undoubtedly has injected a high degree of party influence or politicisation into the selection of judges. So Montenegro is an interesting case. It looks a lot more rosy and a lot more optimistic and a lot more successful than perhaps it is when you delve a bit more deeply. I could talk a lot about the happy in question to be drawn out on any of the cases, but I just want to sort of move to some concluding comments, because I really do want to hear comments and to get some sort of feedback from you. By way of conclusion, really just to reiterate some of the things that I said at the beginning. There has undoubtedly been greater inclusion of NGOs. NGOs and civil society organisations, and we shamefully use them, I noticed in the working paper, interchangeably, which we shouldn't do. But certainly the non-governmental actors that we talked to who were involved in the scoping exercises and in helping to establish benchmarking felt that they were involved in a much more meaningful way at an earlier stage. Compared to similar situations in previous enlargements. They were involved earlier on, and they were involved not simply as in a consultative capacity. They were very much involved and brought in order to identify and to report and to feed into the various stages. Now, part of that is because the EU has created a much clearer set of stages and processes. So one of the problems was that in Croatia, for example, chapters were opened, there may be some form of consultation, but then it became very, very closed, and civil society organisations found themselves completely excluded, particularly as the process became more technical and there was urgency. So the idea of regular reporting and benchmarks and interim reports and structured dialogue is that there's many more sort of opportunities for dialogue with civil society organisations. There has also been, and this came out very strongly in the in the research and in the data that we've got, that there's quite a lot of horizontal linkage, and that certainly the experience of Romania and Bulgaria, NGOs in Romania, Bulgaria and Croatia, working with their counterparts in the Western Balkans and that kind of linkage. And that's something that the EU has also encouraged. However, the story is more complex. That yes, NGOs are, civil society organizations are involved, but the key determinant of their empowerment or their efficacy or whatever you want to call it seems to be levels of transparency. And that's where, across the countries, there is the greatest variation. And we talk about, we haven't, I'm sure I've written that, I've got to find a better phrase, but it's the idea of glass doors. One of the big tensions in the MaxCap team, and we have not many tensions, but one of our partners who shall remain nameless, who's a non-academic partner, who, working with civil society organisations, who made a huge contribution, very useful, but came to the project very much with the view that civil society must be not just around the table, but in the chair. And this was a very heated debate that we had, because actually quite a number of us felt that the role of civil society was not to be necessarily always round the table, but the critical dimension was the transparency. That actually civil society actors had to be outside and brought in, but able to see the proceedings and to see and to be aware of the process. So in terms of understanding what determines the effectiveness of the new approach, transparency is absolutely critical. It's all very well the EU being very prescriptive about the role of NGOs and this scoping and this in various stages. But if there is a lack of transparency, and if there's a sense in which NGOs or civil society just does not really know what the issues are and at what points they can enter, it's a very simple point in a way, then that does cause difficulty. I want to just finish really by reiterating this tension between accountability and independence. And I'm still trying to sort of write this up in a way that doesn't do a terrible disservice or to probably a very extensive academic literature which looks at exactly this this issue. But it seems to me that there's a particularly difficult balance between independence and accountability to be struck. And it's particularly difficult in, I think, post-communist contexts, where obviously, you know, we all know that fusion of the branches of government and the sort of role of the party, that in itself, irrespective of the legacies of Yugoslavia and the wars of the 90s, that there's a problem of post-communism that makes that balance and achieving that balance particularly difficult. I think there's also the formal and the informal. That there's a tendency to ignore the informal accountability mechanisms and immediately assuming that any interference is naturally going to be inappropriate or something that should be stymied. In other words, I'm not expressing this quite as clearly yet as I want to. The problem with creating new institutions and almost building a wall around them is that you don't just control the formal interference, but you also sever very important informal networks that actually provide lifeblood to the judicial system. In other words, in the case of Serbia, this new judicial academy, which essentially was supported by the EU just to sort of be as independent and autonomous as possible. And actually what it did was sever links with the wider legal community, with a lot of NGOs and people who were working in the NGO sector, who felt that this was now an institution that they could that they were being shut out of or kept away from. So the informal, I think, is very important. I think also that the second point is that being autonomous doesn't necessarily mean there's immunity. In other words, being more powerful and more having more capacity and more professional and better trained doesn't mean that those organisations won't use their power and authority to cultivate new links with those outside of the judiciary and within political parties and elsewhere. And finally, the point about, and this is certainly in the wider literature, that the more powerful the judiciary, the more susceptible. The more susceptible to bribes, to interference, to an attempt to, if you like, colonise justice and the rule of law. And I think that's something, certainly looking forward about, looking ahead towards the sort of difficulties and challenges of the new approach, that is something that I think is really under-theorised and not thought through particularly well. So I'd sort of really like to leave it there, I suppose. I just want to sort of say that it is very much about thinking out loud and pulling out the data from different countries, and I'm sorry that it's a bit patchy with Montenegro and Serbia, but it was really to do so in a rather illustrative way and to give you some sort of indication of how this research hopefully will transform itself into referable publications at some point in the not too distant future. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. We've got plenty of time to try and help you resolve some of these issues continuing. So without any further delay, I'll just open it up for questions and comments from you. And Adam, do you want to take the questions one by one or the group? It's completely up to you. Over to you. Will.
I was really interested in the presentation because I just got back from Serbia where I was working for just over a month on a project funded by USAID on the political economy of judicial reform in Serbia. So I had a sort of crash course in all this, and a lot of what you've been saying I sort of recognise and agree with, especially concerning the reappointment of the judges and all that sort of thing. And the sort of disastrous effects of the intervention of outside aid providers, not least of which are USAID themselves. And I think that actually USAID or the US and the US Embassy and US aid effort has been very influential in judicial reform, perhaps more so than the EU, in fact. And the EU has all this sort of technology of accession, but it's all very theoretical. They don't really terribly much get their hands dirty, whereas USA sort of gets right stuck in and actually does things. For example, they had a big project that was trying to improve the misdemeanor courts in Serbia, which are the sort of small claims courts where all the sort of everyday sort of stuff gets done. And there are huge problems in I don't know about Montenegro, I don't know about Serbia. I mean, there are huge problems. And a lot needs to be done to improve the effectiveness of the courts. For example, there's 2.5 million backlog cases within the Serbian courts. The inefficiency is so great, and the problems they face are so great that it's very difficult to see, just on a practical basis, how they can possibly even talk about the rule of law in Serbia. And it's not just the court cases. It's when you get a judgment, which may take months, years, decades. Can you then enforce the judgment? And it's practically impossible to enforce judgments in Serbia in many cases. In this misdemeanor courts, for example, it's you have to serve the you have to get people into the court on both sides of the case before you can proceed. So people just hide. Mm-hmm. There's no way to bring people to court if they don't want to go to court. Mm-hmm. And they send a letter out to ask someone to appear in the court, and five times out of ten, letter goes to the wrong address because most people, their official address is different to the actual place where they live. Mm-hmm. So the whole court system really does need a lot of improvement. But I think, maybe sort of getting off at a tangent a bit, but I think if I could just add to what you've said, on the dimension of what are these things that have gone wrong in addition to the reappointment of the judges, I think one big thing that's gone wrong, which you didn't mention, which was the transition of the prosecuting role, or the investigatory role, from the judges to the prosecution service. And this has also further made all these problems I've been talking about much, much worse, because the prosecutors have not had don't have any tradition of investigating cases. It used to be in the hands of the judges, and so when this change was made, then the capacity of the justice system to investigate cases became much weaker.
Mm.
And so the whole thing seems to be going in the wrong direction. Mm. And I think what it illustrates is the this issue of the outside aid agencies, what role they play, and the way in which the aid agencies coming from different directions, from different traditions, can cause a lot of confusion and a lot of sort of incoherence in policy making within these countries, because they're getting advice from different systems. For example, the Serbian judicial system is based upon the continental civil law practice, which is where you have this investigatory power in the hands of the judges, whereas in Britain and in America they have the common law practice, where you don't have that at all. So when the US came along and tried to make this change to the prosecutors, it didn't really understand that, and created a whole lot of mess. And then another way, which could perhaps expand a little bit, is one of the things you were saying about the sort of political influence and informal norms. I think that behind the court system and the judicial system, there are a lot of power networks at play,
yeah,
and they are influencing, through informal means, the court procedures and the court decisions. And so working just at the formal level isn't really going to solve the problem. And then finally, the third way I sort of add to what you're saying is this issue about tension between independence and accountability. I came to this on the same basis as you, thinking that these things are somehow opposites, it's independence versus accountability. But in fact, if you think about it, the question is, independence from whom and accountable to whom? And from our way of looking at it, there may be a tension, but from another way of looking at it, they may not necessarily be in so much tension to each other. I mean, what you really want is independence from the political influence and accountability to the people, to the rule of law.
I think that's a very good way of expressing it. And I think that one thing that certainly came out quite often in the interviews in all of the countries was that if civil society organisations speaking on behalf of citizens, because obviously it wasn't about interviewing citizens, but saying that actually for what bothers most people is the track record of actually cases being brought to court and resolved,
mm-hmm.
and exactly as you describe. And it's quite bizarre really to think back that pre this new approach, that the EU in all of the post-communist countries, the new member states, was quite happy to close chapters 23 and 24 on the basis that these things were removed without really gathering any significant data on how the judicial system was actually functioning in terms of bringing cases to court and resolving them, which, quite understandably, I think it's very reasonable that that's what citizens would be most concerned about. And that's why the case in Serbia of this complete disaster of sacking judges at a time when that just all it did was exacerbate an enormous backlog and effectively paralyze the judicial system. And the EU's voice in that was, although it did sort of start criticising and expressing its concern, initially it thought that was quite a good idea. And to me, that's very illustrative of how focusing on one dimension and not perhaps focusing on the importance of getting the system working and making sure the system is actually working. But thanks for those comments.
Well, I have many questions, but I've been trying to organize them in my head. Well, the first one that I was wondering, I wanted to ask you about the new approach, and you mentioned that, I mean, not only is the focus now on these chapters, but also we have this balance clauses, which means that if there isn't enough progress, not only more chapters will not be open. And I think it was not last year, it was in 2014, when in the case of Montenegro, there was this debate whether we should activate this clause because progress was not sufficient. Do you think that the European Commission will, and again, in the case of Serbia, we can see that we have not only one, but two, because of Chapter 35 as well, a normalization process, which Kosovo is also included as another break in the accession negotiation process, which I think is a significant novelty compared to what we had with Croatia, Bulgaria and Romania with the 2004 enlargement. Do you think that the European Commission will ever consider invoking these balance clauses? Because I think it's highly unlikely and it's going to be not particularly productive. And another question I was wondering, how do you, because I'm not an expert on Serbia or Montenegro. I've been following some of the developments there, but my understanding was the domestic context is very different. So what are the major issues that you have been dealing when trying to put up a comparative design? Because I was told in the case of Montenegro that the government is very willing and happy to let the NGO participate in shaking the new policies, where this was not the case in Serbia. And they said, yeah, we let them follow the process, but they're not advised to participate. And European Commission was perfectly fine with that approach, say it's okay, we can continue in those directions. And then, I mean, again, we can see in the case of Serbia, although the idea was to open first Chapter 23 and 24, we started with Chapter 35 and 11. So those chapters have not been open. I mean, what does it mean about it? I mean, there are other issues that are involved, but still, what are some of the biggest challenges that you have had while trying to look at the similar issues in Serbia and Montenegro? I find it very fascinating to hear more about.
I mean, it's a very good point. I mean, it's very difficult to take these countries and to do this sort of research across these countries without coming across, you know, these difficult, quite stark differences. I mean, that's why I mentioned transparency, because I think that is the key factor, I think, in terms of you know, how transparent, and that again may be the product of a whole series of other circumstances, but certainly one of the problems seems to be in Serbia a very centralised and very closed system that meant that you know, it's very difficult for other, and albeit apart from a very small number of NGOs or civil society organisations, to gain any access at all. Whereas in Montenegro, it seemed to be a much smaller country, a much closer sort of overlap between the sort of state and non-state sector. So I think there were absolute different important differences. With regard to your question about whether they would evoke, I mean, we can get into all sorts of speculation around this. I mean, I just think that on looking at this new approach with one set of eyes, if you will, you think, wow, the EU's really boxed itself in now. You know, it's almost annihilated the prospect of politics and pragmatism and the sort of, you know, veering from the script that we know the EU, well, really explains so much of the fifth enlargement, you know, about bringing countries, suddenly accelerating the entry of certain countries as opposed to others. You know, has this prevented such a podcast? Well, clearly not. I mean, the whole notion of demonstrating a track record, when you're still using a level of report, you know, the same tools of reporting which come down to the annual reports and what have you, you know, presumably if the time comes where it's expedient to move a country forward and there is a narrative that, I'm being very cynical, the narrative that can be constructed to say that there is progress being made. And ultimately that's what it comes down to. The track record is about the rate of progress rather than the sort of finite, that's what it's going to judge. So I don't think it's firewalled from that kind of pragmatism. The other problem, the other dimension to that is, of course, extra conditionality. Some people interpret 2024 saying, okay, this is the things you have to do, it's very rigid. But we're already seeing evidence of things being attached to that, and all of a sudden, then there's another chapter that you have to open, or there's other things. So I think, well, for better or for worse, there's a very high level still of pragmatism. But I do remain optimistic or positive. I think it's just positive that it's giving a clearer steer as to what is important. I think the legacy of the CVM, and I think the legacy of having to intervene after accession to try to deal with what were deemed to be low levels of compliance and judicial problems, as it were, I think is a big scar, you know, scarred the Commission in that respect.
But there is a sense here of a double conditionality which is imposed on these on this new approach, which I think, in a sense, reinforces people's belief in the region that we are being more and more hurdles are being added to our accession process. So the new approach is a condition that's set on the opening and closing of these two chapters for the accession of that country to the European Union. But these balance clauses also suggest that not only will it be part of your accession criteria, but it also means if you don't fulfil these, we're not going to negotiate on anything else.
So it's a double conditionality,
reinforcing certain other stereotypes which exist.
I think it would be absolutely outrageous for that reason if it... But the only positive side, or the other side of that is that it is also an instrument or an approach that is galvanising the EU to... basically refine some of its interventions accordingly. So in other words, the emphasis on EPA funds and the targeting EPA funds and the kind of reinforcement of twinning programmes, I mean, you may say, well, it's very little compensation for what are even more rigid conditions, but I do think there has been a genuine sort of recognition that, yes, you're setting the bar particularly high and you're saying these are what's important, and that the EU has a responsibility to actually try and sort this out and to intervene and support, rather than just saying, well, you know, you've not made any progress and you haven't improved. There's still political... The most recent report on Serbia, this is what I'm talking about before, the last three, 2012, 13, 14, 15, have said that there is still... They've commended Serbia on certain constitutional reforms, certain improvements in the rule of law, but then add this comment which says, but there's still scope for political interference. And I think, well, can you be a bit more specific? Or can we, you know, isn't that always the case? The scope? What do they actually mean by that? And hopefully, I mean, if the new approach works, then that will have to then be a cue. It should lead to some kind of structured dialogue or interventions or funding that will hopefully close that gap. I mean, that would be the ideal scenario.
I think it goes back to the problems what you mentioned before, that about double standards. I mean, again, we can see Bulgaria and Romania, very interesting example in the case of the CVM. We can see just the example now with Poland, the rule of law mechanism, which was killed by the member states. This was supposed to be a mechanism that was built and developed on the basis of the CVM in order to monitor and intervene in all of EU member states if there are any problems with the rule of law. There was only one meeting. The mechanism was set in 2014. Last November, there was a very brief discussion in the Council where everybody was politically correct and they said that they will approach these issues very cautiously because they're incredibly sensitive. And now we can see, I mean, again, the European Commission making an example of Poland while not doing anything about Hungary, while at the same time not even mentioning what's happening right now in Bulgaria. Although I think it's admirable what the European Commission is trying to do now with the Western Balkans, when you have those issues not resolved at EU level, it's very difficult to say to the countries, to candidate countries, that this is what you have to, the standards that you need to comply with and the standards that you have to meet, when clearly, as we've mentioned before, that there is no EU model for a judicial system. We can say what the expectations is that this judicial system should be working efficiently and be independent, but we don't have a recipe as to how to make the judicial system work fine. And I mean, again, Bulgaria and Romania, because I know better, a very fine example. If we focus on institutions, we can see in Romania, the integrity and the anti-corruption institutions have done a very good job and significantly improved the track record of fight against corruption. In Bulgaria, there have been numerous institutions that have functioned for 9 to 12 months and have produced absolutely nothing. So it's a...
Kevin.
A basic, limited, rudimentary question. I was thinking in terms of the theme of conditionality and looking at it in a more generic fashion. Conditionality in different contexts. In the Greek case, you might say that bailout conditionality has failed in part because of the inability of the European Union to empower the pro-reformers. In fact, in the opposite, to destroy the careers of pro-reformers. And we know from imperial powers, divide and rule, winning friends and influencing people, etc., is the key. And I took particular note in your focus and sector of judicial reform. You mentioned the establishment in Serbia of a judicial academy funded by the European Union. In your particular sector, are there other examples where we could see an implicit strategy of trying to use EU support, actual material resources, to try to reconfigure coalitions of crudely reformers and their opponents, that is to win friends, to create a coalition that's domestically of which would be acceptable in the eyes of the European Union for the common purposes.
It's a very good question. Well, I think answering in a rather certain sense, I mean, I pick up on something that Will said in his comments. I think what I was thinking about this is that, of course, the EU uses a technical capacity building language to divert its, or rather to construct new networks or elites or institutions, and it's certainly doing, that's what's illustrated here very, very clearly, that the idea that somehow, you know, overtly you need to build something new that is severed and different and of a European standard. And it talks about European standards. Well, of course, there isn't a European standard of judicial in the same way as there isn't any kind of perfect independence or isolation. And yet it's that idea. And it, of course, that reveals a contempt for politics and for political process and institutions that is implicit rather than explicit. And I suppose I kind of can't help but think, well, does that go back to a kind of fundamental problem that you have with these countries, that unlike the Central East European countries, where there was this evidence of revolution and democrats in power, and therefore the EU's role was first and foremost about consolidating their power and making sure those people stayed in power, then actually the EU's ended up with a bunch of with elites that it doesn't really like and isn't convinced are worthy, and therefore that's why it sort of put, and presumably it's true in Greece as well, you know, that the people it's having to work with are people that it has a huge amount of contempt for. And obviously that then subverts conditionality, makes a mockery of conditionality. And I know I'm not really answering your question, Kevin, but it's really just thinking this through more than anything.
You are, if I could just add a couple of sentences. Yeah. Sometimes in the Greek context, and I ask, well, what could the European Union have done more? What more could the European Union have done? In a context where both the EU and, yes, the IMF have sent more technical advisers into Greece than any other IMF case ever. In absolute numbers, the number of technical advisers going into Greece is greater than any other post-war case. However, there is the connecting with your last point, this theme of, as it were, ending up with elites it doesn't like, it showing inadequate support for relevant elites, etc. And pro-reformers having careers destroyed because of clumsy targets and impossible conditions. But it just struck me that you could envisage a strategy which is to provide resources rather like, I don't mean anything negative about this, rather like, say, the German foundations attached to political parties, mm-hmm. Adenauer and Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, etc., going in and providing resources to build pro-reform coalitions. Mm-hmm. And I was just struck with your example of the Judicial Academy, whether really there's any other examples of trying to go in and provide resources to support what might crudely be regarded as pro-reform leaders.
No, I think, and again, Bill's example, Will's example of USAID, and this, I think there's a lot of competing conditionality there around, but both are derived from a sense in which there's almost a kind of after the event need to build new coalitions and new void and new support, and I mean, I think going with the Greek examples are very interesting. I mean, the naivety, if you like, of the EU when it dealt with, or when it sort of initially after the collapse of communism, dealing with the first tranche of candidates, was perhaps that it believed that because these new Democrats or pro democratic voices were at the political helm. That it didn't really matter that you had media control, you had judicial judges that had been there since the 1960s or whatever, and were very much locked in place. There was also naivety. It's almost an inversion of that actually, yes. You've now got to do something about the judges because you need them on side because you can't trust the political elites.
Will, did you have a point
related
to this?
That the reformists, and I think unfortunately in Serbia the government and the prime minister managed to convince the international community that they are the reformists and that they are the holders of this thing called reform, and they are pushing it through against opposition, and they're at the forefront, where in fact it's actually also those very same people who have their complete control through those informal networks of the courts and the judiciary, and they're able to, and the media, and they're able to manipulate it. For example, in the recent case of 80 arrests on corruption charges last week or a couple of weeks ago, all of whom are connected to the Democratic Party or to no party, therefore not having any protector. So, I think the EU is swallowed this sort of story. The reform that's taking place, and they're happy to go along with it as long as Serbia looks as though it's playing ball over Kosovo. They don't really mind quite what happens internally.
Listening to this, I mean, it's not an area I know a lot about, but obviously it's terribly interesting and extremely important. And one of the things that one of the most interesting talks I ever heard of was at the Foreign Office by a British judge who'd been sent out to Kosovo as part of the EULEX mission. And to hear him talk about his experiences of trying to create a judicial system, what really stood out was the difference, and I think Will had sort of touched on this, between a British model and a continental model. And he was saying, which was absolutely fascinating, is he sort of explained the career structure of a judge in this country. And basically it can be boiled down to, you don't really start until you're about 45. And then you'll start as a part-time judge. And the salaries and everything. And he said that after him, he never expected another British judge to go out to the Balkans to advise. Because he said, look, there's just no way you can find the people with that talent who are willing at that stage to give up and go out and give their chunk of their time. And he said, in fact, what you were finding was that you had, and he said, look, you know, no disrespect to anybody in this moment who might be offended by what I'm saying, but he said, you had washed up Bavarian traffic court judges, or else you had like 29-year-old Slovak, you know, because of a very, very different structure. And it was actually very telling to say how the people who were attracted to giving advice and supporting judicial reform in the Kosovo case were just really wholly unsuited to be doing that. And I wondered the extent to which, you know, looking at the case of Montenegro and Serbia, that's the same, that, you know, the European Union comes in and, as you said, that there isn't a model of how a judiciary should be structured. And we have a particular model in this country, I accept, that actually stands rather apart from most of the rest of the continent. And whether, when we're looking at how the European Union is providing that expertise, is it really providing the expertise at the very best level from the other countries, or taking in these people who just really, you know, had a career structure within the law, with as judges, have never done anything else, weren't particularly good at this, and who might be then willing to go and take on these sorts of advisory roles?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that, I mean, for me, as I still defend, I mean, I still defend aspects of this new approach, and sit in this room and get more cynical, which always happens. But I need
to do with the room.
yes, but for me, the thing that I find most ridiculous about it is the new institutions bit. You know, I think that of all of, and that's true in every country, to a lesser extent, Serbia is the extreme example, where, you know, taking something that's a grassroots, bottom-up judicial training and turning it into this kind of top-down academy, and I keep saying top of the hill, it wasn't top of the hill, but it's the idea of a king. That to me seems just bizarre, you know, and the constructivist in me thinks, well, the easiest thing you can do, and the thing they're doing correctly, is to increase transparency, involve as many different voices as you can, and to really try to build, I think even building capacities is a good idea. But I think there's almost a kind of, in fact, an obsession with this idea of hermetically sealing them from political interference. And it comes back to the point about the fact that it's just born out of a huge contempt for political elites, which, you know, which means that you kind of, that can be the worst possible thing, that even if these judges are clearing the decks and getting through the cases and they're accountable to people and people like them, the fact they may have any kind of party affiliations or political or being appointed is just so unpalatable. And of course we all know that, you know, most West liberal democratic citizens have some kind of patronage around, you know, the judiciary, whether it's formal or informal. So I think in terms of what's good here is that particularly EPA funding, the twinning process, the emphasis on track record, and they are intent on monitoring the extent to which courts are functioning and judges. You know, and as always with judging EU strategies and tools, it's about sort of standing back from the reality. Just because they don't deliver the degree of change doesn't necessarily mean they're not effective strategies. It could just be that the countries aren't making any progress, which is a difficult one to swallow, I know. But, you know, I think there's a tendency to conflate the two, that because Serbia isn't an improvement, then it naturally must be the fault of the EU's strategies. Well, yes and no. You know, I mean, there is a tendency to say, well, you know, in the same way with Greece, do we now say that enlargement's been a total disaster because there was Greece, but also Poland and Hungary? Well, no, I think.
Okay, we've got
might have to crawl out of my hands and knees now.
Time for a couple of questions. If there are more than one question, we'll take them together and then we'll call that the last round. Claire.
Yeah, thank you.
Anybody else apart from Claire?
My question sort of comes out of what you just, your reference to Poland and Hungary, and I've got it, they're sort of trying to pull out some, ask you to pull out some broader comments about this notion of the EU transformative effect. If we look back at the Visegrad Four in particular, I would have always argued that they had, and you did say this, very good, reasonably good starting conditions, and that the EU's role was perhaps one more of consolidation than transformation. And then you've presented this picture of a much more sort of piecemeal EU having an effect, IPA, targeted interventions, rather than sort of transforming the whole political and economic systems of these countries, something much more measured. And I wondered if, you know, so there's a lowering of, is there a lowering of expectations going on? And then there's this, also this issue of the endless stages of conditionality, which undermine the credibility of the EU in the region, because it's sort of someday, maybe, never. And so I sort of wanted to ask you, it's not very organised, but there's sort of to draw some comparisons between Central Eastern European 2004 enlargement, particularly focusing on those Visegrad countries, and then what we see now. And I guess I would fundamentally argue that the primacy of the domestic context hasn't gone away. And that's really the key variable we need to understand, how these different domestic situations are interacting with what's coming from the EU.
I think, it's a really good question, because, and even in the context of the MATSCAP project, because in the 3 years that we've been working on the research and sort of meeting in regularly, I mean, the things unfolding in Ukraine and in Hungary, I mean, and Ukraine, but Hungary and now Poland. And I think that, my own view is that in a way, that it's always been, the transformative has been a system of rules and systems of processes and institutions. And in a sense, what Poland is doing, and I don't mean this in any flippant way, and to denigrate, I don't mean this to sort of, downplay the impact of what's happening, but in a sense that it is about almost subjecting those rules, testing them against a kind of set of different political contexts. I mean, Antoinette Dimitrova has written a very good paper where she makes this point very eloquently, that these countries were too similar, and therefore it wasn't a good test, it wasn't a good basis on which to construct a kind of science of Europeanisation. But actually, the point I think is more that they weren't that similar, there were just too few of them, and it was a time shot. It was a shot in time that there wasn't. We were talking about a tiny period of time, relatively. So, was the assumption that Poland's politics would remain as it was in the 1990s or the early the last decade? Well, why did anybody think that would be so? I mean, it's just taken on a new dimension. So it's not just they were too similar. It's the fact that it was a snapshot, and we were judging the transformative power of Europe against a set of political elites and parties that were broadly compliant and were willing to work. And maybe they've just gained a confidence after X number of years as being full member states. And I'm not answering your question. I'm really conscious of that. But I think it comes down to this point that Kevin was making, and we're talking about elites. I think that my sense, and I may be completely wrong, is that part of the realisation that the EU has is that this kind of unmovable elites in these countries, and certainly the work that Vesna and others have done, the fact that there's a kind of, it always reminds me of the work by people like Klaus Offer, who were almost, they were talking about Central Eastern Europe, but their resonance is about the Balkans more than it's, their fear was that there was this impenetrable elite in Central Eastern Europe that would dominate the economy, the state, and the politics, and the judicial, and it would be unmovable. Well, maybe so, but it's much, much more of a problem in these countries, he says, rather in a rather generalising way. I answered the question at all. I'm a bit tired.
All right, well, let's draw the cities to a close. Before we thank Adam and drag him across the streets of the pub for a drink, I think against his better judgment and interest, can I just make a couple of small announcements about our next meetings? Next Wednesday, the 27th of January, we've got a special guest lecture by Valentin Insko, who's the High Representative in Bosnia-Herzegovina. talking on Bosnia 20 years after Dayton. And this will be at 6 o'clock in the Wolfson Theatre in the new academic building. And then we return to our normal schedule of seminars in 2 weeks' time on Tuesday the 2nd of February. Dr. Eli Gatova, who's in the front row of this evening's audience and who's a fellow with us here at LISI, is speaking on post-accession conditionality, monitoring without punishment. Ooh. Same time, same place. We hope to see you at these events. And Adam, thank you very much for this evening.